Welcome to Little Atoms on Resonance 104.4 FM, a live talk show based around ideas of the Enlightenment.
Little Atoms is presented by Neil Denny, Padraig Reedy, Richard Saunderson, and Rebecca Watson, as well as regular mystery guest presenters.
Little Atoms makes no claims to balance. We actively promote science, freedom of expression, skepticism, and secular humanism. This means we can often end up talking about superstition, religious fundamentalism, censorship, and conspiracy theory.
Our guests bring ideas that are challenging, sometimes controversial, often polemical, but always interesting. Welcome to another Little Atoms, tonight with me, Neil Denny. The show features a pre-recorded interview with the science writer Sue Armstrong. Sue Armstrong is a science writer and broadcaster living in Edinburgh. As a foreign correspondent, she worked for a variety of media, including The New Scientist and the BBC World Service. She has also undertaken a variety of assignments writing reports for the World Health Organization and the Joint United Nations Programme on HIV/AIDS. Sue's latest book is A Matter of Life and Death, Inside the Hidden World of the Pathologist. I've been joined today by Sue Armstrong. Sue, thanks very much for speaking to Little Atoms.
Thank you. Good to be speaking to you.
Can we talk a little bit about your background first and how you got into being, because you talk about this in the preamble to the book, about how you became a medical journalist, and I want that to sort of lead up to why you decided to write about pathologists, basically.
Okay. Well, I grew up in a medical family, very much surrounded by medics. My dad was a doctor of tropical medicine, and my sister became a doctor, and my other sister a nurse, and she married a doctor, and my mother was a physio. And it was a very medical family, and I would have done medicine because I was always interested in it. But I fell at the first hurdle when I was trying to do zoology A-level, and I found even digging up an earthworm difficult, let alone cutting it up. And so I went towards the other thing, which I was really fascinated by, which was writing, and started in journalism. And then I just got a break into working with the World Health Organization. Somebody introduced me to some guy who wanted somebody to make silk purses out of sow's ears, taking a lot of medical papers and making them accessible to the general public. And I got caught up in that and then did a lot of writing about medical things and decided that's where my passion was.
So let's talk about, well, first of all, let's talk about what a pathologist is and what they do briefly.
Okay, well, I think pathology is one of the most misunderstood disciplines.
Indeed.
Because basically people think that most people just assume it's forensic pathology, and they get an image of somebody in a white coat leaning over a cadaver with a scalpel and trying to decide exactly when somebody died and what they died of. Whereas in fact, forensic pathology is the smallest area of pathology. And basically, pathology is the scientific study of diseases and disease processes. So it's basically the information that underpins all healthcare.
It's hard to overstate how vital pathology is to the whole medical establishment. But
exactly.
One of the themes that comes out of the interview, the book is, we should explain, a series of interviews with prominent pathologists. And one of the things that comes out is sort of how, you've already suggested it's misunderstood, but how it's also seen as a backroom role and not as glamorous as being, you know, a surgeon or a doctor. So is that something that made you want to write about it?
Well, it wasn't so much that. I mean, what made me write about it was that I had met a pathologist, a very colourful character, at Dundee University when I was researching some other story some time back for some radio programmes. And he was a pathologist, and he phoned me up when the Alder Hey crisis started, which was, if you'll remember, when there was the crisis about a sort of maverick pathologist at Alder Hey Children's Hospital who had been doing autopsies on children, and he'd been keeping the organs, retaining the organs, and parents hadn't understood that this was happening. And then it was discovered, and there was real shock that the little bodies that they'd been given back to bury had not been complete. And suddenly they got very upset, and the media got very upset as well. and started calling pathologists doctors of death. And my friend phoned me one evening and just said, look at this, it's terrible. People don't understand how important we are, and there's a real backlash against us at the moment. And it made me very interested, and I thought, well, that's an interesting thing to study. So I got in touch with the BBC and said, how's about doing some programmes on who pathologists are, what sort of people go into pathology, and what they actually do. And I made a couple of programmes, the first one just allowing pathologists to talk about themselves, how they'd got into the discipline, what had interested them about it. Then the second one followed a woman who had had breast cancer, and she told me her story. And we followed that with following samples from a biopsy and breast tissue from surgery and so on to the pathology lab and seeing what it was that the pathologist did. Because, of course, they're the ones who decide exactly what sort of cancer it is and what the prognosis is and how much tissue the surgeon needs to take away and whether there's, when they take lymph nodes and things like that, whether the cancer has spread. So they really are the linchpin in the clinical team. And they were just fascinating programs, really, really interesting. And so that's how it all came about.
So let's talk a little bit about how you went about actually writing the book. How did you find people to interview and go about actually? Because I said it's a series of interviews, so presumably you had to travel quite a bit to meet these people.
I did. I decided I wanted to make it as... I wanted to find the most interesting people. And I started off talking to my friends at the Pathological Society in London, and they gave me a few leads. But when I had been doing the radio programmes, I had been given some little books by a friend of mine, written by a pathologist in the United States who's a lovely writer, and he'd written a series of essays on the pathologist's world, which was very much the sort of thing introducing people to what really went on in the path lab. And so I knew that I wanted to interview him, and one thing led to another, really. You know, I'd speak to one person and they'd say, oh, you should speak to my friend so-and-so who's been doing cancer research. And I was particularly interested in AIDS too, because one of the big strands of my work has been following the AIDS pandemic since the very beginning, and I've travelled around the world looking at it. So I was very interested to meet one of the pathologists who has shed most light on what happens in different areas of the world when people get HIV. Who's Sebastian Lucas?
Yeah, as one of the examples I was going to. Try and talk about a little bit later.
Yeah, no, he's a fascinating character. And so I met him, and then, you know, he would suggest one of his friends in the States and so on, and it just went round from there, really.
When you're talking to such eminent people, obviously it's quite a small world, but it is really nice how often the pathologists will mention another one that you've interviewed, or they will say that this other person was my mentor or taught, you know, they taught me. And And that comes across quite well in the book.
Well, I think that's one of the most important things, because what was noticeable was that most of these people had gone into medicine as ordinary medics,
mm-hmm.
And they were doing medical training, and they didn't know when they started their medical training what pathology was and what pathologists did. And quite a number of them found that what made them turn towards that specialty was meeting somebody really charismatic who became their mentor. Nearly all of them had mentors and good examples, good anecdotes about the people who had taught them. And the thing that most drove them, I suppose, was that you found these were people who were really curious, not just to know what ails a person, why they're sick, but exactly what has happened, what's gone on in the body and what the little critters are that have caused it and that sort of thing. So they become really interested in the science of what's gone on behind the scenes. But nearly all of them did have very strong mentors.
Let's have a look at some of the examples, and we'll speak about some of the individual pathologists and their particular fields. And I suppose we should start with perhaps quite a lurid one. Tell us about your day out at Bill Bassey's body farm, first of all.
Well, yeah, it's quite interesting, because one of the things, the Pathological Society was involved in the book, and they were really keen that the general public got to know who they were and not just the forensic people. But, of course, everybody's fascinated by forensics, and I thought crazy not to have a few forensic people in the book, because people are fascinated. And Bill Bass's story, Bill Bass runs this facility in the United States called called The Body Farm. And I had read about it while I was doing other articles and other radio broadcasts and so on. And I'd always wanted to do more on this. So I thought, well, this is my opportunity. And basically what it is Bill Bass was working as a forensic anthropologist, which is a sort of related field. And he'd been digging up skeletons of the Plains Indians for a long time and working with the Smithsonian Institution. And he got asked by the local police station to help with forensic work. And he said what was really, really difficult was finding out how long a body had been dead. And he said it was easy enough to discover, you know, what sex it was, what age the person was, but the big thing was the time of death. And he said when he started looking through the literature for information about maggots and what maggots do and so on, he found there was very little. So he kept in the back of his mind that there really needed to be some scientific study about how bodies decompose. And then what happened was he was asked to identify one body and give information about it that had been dug up, and it had been buried in a lead coffin somewhere. And there was still some sort of pink tissue on the bones. And so he reckoned this must have been dead about 6 months. And he got the sex of the person and the age of the person and all those and the race of the person all right. But he discovered subsequently that he'd been out by 112 years in how long this body had been dead. And that just clinched it. He thought we must do some proper scientific study about, you know, which bits fall off first and under what circumstances things happen. And so he started this facility in the University of Tennessee, in Knoxville, Tennessee, where he put out bodies just in all sorts of different conditions, out in the fields, under leaf mold, in shallow graves, wrapped up in carpets and all sorts of things, and then literally just studied how the processes of decomposition happened. And they reckon that now most of what is understood across the world, and certainly in America, about how long a body has been dead come from studies done at the body farm.
What's that actually like to visit? I mean, you were there and you painted quite sort of a nice sort of silver and rural scene.
Well, it was amazing. I went to Tennessee. I met Bill Bass, who's now an elderly man. He met me at the airport, and he was a lovely sort of old-fashioned Southern gentleman. And he just said to me straight away, I thought I was going to his office or perhaps his house to interview him, but he said, no, I'll take you to the facility. And so we went straight down to this thing, and I felt a bit worried about it before I got there. But he gave me a little introduction as to why he'd started it and so on. And then we went in, and there were quite a number of bodies lying about, but I wasn't in the least bit fazed by it. There was nothing undignified about it. There was nothing creepy about it. It was all extremely peaceful. And it was a lovely autumn day, so there were little birds hopping around, and luckily it was slightly cool, so the smell wasn't overpowering. And Bill Bass just told me what sort of studies were being done on the different bodies. And I just found it fascinating. Then he took me into the archives where the bodies finally end up when they're down to skeletons. And then the bodies are cleaned and the skeletons are put in boxes of bones and so on. And every so often they have a sort of mass service and a burial, and just to sort of show respect to the bodies. But it was wonderful. It was very scientific. You felt that this was a very respected scientific inquiry.
But also, I mean, you just mentioned that, but I was going to say that one of the things that comes across is, you know, although it's a scientific establishment, there is definitely respect being paid to the remains, isn't there?
Absolutely.
Of describe that.
Yes, and actually that's one of the sad things, because, you know, the Alder Hey thing painted the picture of pathologists, the ones who do the post-mortems, as being sort of ghouls, as though they're doing it purely for their own some sort of ghoulish pleasure, where this couldn't be further from the truth. And I found all of the people that I interviewed, I never ever found lack of respect for the bodies or for the feelings of the relatives or anything like that. It was really all done in the interest of establishing why a person had died and what was the underlying reason and whether things could have been done better next time. I mean, you know, I find them a thoroughly respectful bunch, really.
When you mentioned Alder Hey at the beginning, and again, this is something I was going to sort of bring up later in the interview, but and we may as well bring up that again now. You mentioned that, you know, the idea of a maverick pathologist, and it sort of strikes me as having a sort of a strange parallel with the Norwich climate change email controversy that happened recently, and that it's something that's sort of been spun as completely discrediting an industry, basically. But what we're actually really talking about is the day-to-day working practices of one person.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, that was it. I think, I mean, I don't know much about this particular person, but I think probably it was just a question of him being overwhelmed by the amount of work that there was to do, because often they do have a huge workload. And I think he just didn't get round to looking after the specimens that were kept as well as he should have done. And this is what gave it the sort of ghoulish aspect. Because, in fact, that had been the practice. It isn't the practice any longer, but it had been the practice over most of Europe that, especially when there were paediatric autopsies, the organs and things were kept, and not at all for any ghoulish purposes, but because this was a sort of basis of research into congenital heart disease and lung diseases and all sorts of things. You so badly need the materials to be able to make progress in medicine.
Well, that's it. I mean, one wonders how that progress can be made without those materials.
Well, it can't. That's the truth. And so, you know, that what's happened now is that the rules have been very much tightened up. And a lot of people think, you know, the rules certainly did need changing. Some of the practices were anachronistic, or they were out of step with public attitudes. And so things did need changing. And the general public needed to be more aware and more involved with these things. But to tighten things to the extent that material just can't be kept or can't be used without, you know, real leaping through hoops is really going to cause problems for all of us. It just means that scientific advance and understanding of diseases is going to be much slowed up. That's the truth.
Let's look at a case study where that becomes relevant to the research then, because you've already mentioned Sebastian Lucas and his work in Africa on AIDS, and he basically discovered the link between AIDS and tuberculosis. And he mentions at the end of your interview that a lot of the work that he was carrying out, and we're only talking about the 1990s here, you know, it's not 40 years ago or anything, a lot of the work that he carried out would now be impossible to do. So let's talk about what was he actually doing? What did he do to discover that link that would perhaps now be frowned upon?
Well, he spent a lot of time in Africa, because in Uganda, because it was at the beginning of the AIDS epidemic, and people didn't know what was happening. They just knew that they'd got these people who were very sick and were wasting away, and it was called Slim disease at that time. So he went out and he was looking at what people were dying of. So he did masses and masses of autopsies. And in the hospitals, I think in the French system, he was in Côte d'Ivoire for some time. And in the French system, apparently, if somebody dies in a teaching hospital or something like that, it can be automatic that you do an autopsy. And so there wouldn't have had to be all the consent forms and things that you'd need over here.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they were taking bits of material, keeping slides and things like that for studying in pathology labs in Britain and all around the place, that just would not be possible today. Well, it would be possible, but with massive, you'd have to go through massive consent processes and ethical committees and that sort of thing. So it would just hold things up enormously.
You're listening to Little Atoms. I'm Neil Denny, and I'm talking to Sue Armstrong about her book A Matter of Life and Death. One of the things that's quite striking, Sue, in the examples of pathologists that you choose to interview, is how many of them have backgrounds in or started off working in sort of repressive regimes or dictatorships, or, and I'm thinking of like the generals era Argentina or apartheid South Africa, for instance. There's an interesting thread there. I wonder why that might be. But then I suppose they had a lot more raw material to work on, perhaps.
I don't think that's what led it at all. I think, again, it was quite striking, because, as you say, I interviewed several people who had fled Argentina, had to get out of Argentina. In fact, three of them had been there. And then apartheid South Africa, and he was an Indian pathologist, so he'd had a really rough time in, even trying to get a training. But I think it was just coincidental, really. I don't think there was anything to do with it being easier or having more material or anything like that.
Okay, another one of the aspects that comes up quite a lot in the book is obviously how useful pathology is in those regimes after those regimes have been overthrown. So, for instance, there's a couple of examples where you talk about the use of pathologists in Bosnia and Kosovo, and there's an incredibly striking image. One of the pathologists, Sue Black, who talks about speaking to a man whose entire family, and we're talking about like 15 people,
yes,
had been murdered, and how she basically... Well, you take up that story, because it's yes. incredible.
Yes. I mean, I've got, as I say, I thought that it would be crazy to bypass the forensic aspect of things, because there are some wonderful examples there. And yes, I mean, that the forensic people who had been working with war crimes in Bosnia and or in the Balkans and so on, they were real. They gave real good examples of why pathology is just so important. That, you know, they had been uncovering mass graves, and Sue Black's story was just heartrending. That she came across a man whose family had been, he was with his family on, and they were trundling along in a little cart, and they'd been bombed, and the whole of his family had been killed. He was about the only survivor. And they were all buried in one place, and he said that for them to go to heaven, he needed to bury them all, he needed to bury them all separately. And so she had to, they dug up the graves, disinterred the bodies, and she had to piece together all the bits and pieces of the bones. And she was a brilliant, brilliant anatomist. And she could decide which was a sort of the 18-year-old boy and which might be one of the 8-year-old twins or something like that. And she worked all on her own, because she was an expert in that. And she separated all the bones from this sort of mass grave, and gave the man back 11 body bags with the different members of his family in it. And, I mean, her story was just heartrending. But I heard that from one or two of the forensic pathologists who'd been involved in human rights work.
To finish off then, let's go back to some examples of, because despite your reservations, I do seem to be concentrating on the the forensic pathologist side of it. So let's look at a couple of examples of research into disease, and one that obviously has incredible relevance at the moment is Jeffrey Taubenberger's investigation of Spanish flu, the original flu pandemic. So tell us a little bit about that.
Yes, now that was a fascinating story. And that was one that, again, I had stumbled across just in reading about the flu and so on. And some years back I did some radio broadcasts on new and emerging diseases. And I knew that flu was one of the things that the experts are really worried about, though the general public doesn't seem to recognize that we could get something really nasty. So I wanted to go and meet Jeffrey Taubenberger, and he turned out to be a really fascinating character. He had been working at the Armed Forces Institute of Pathology in Washington, and this was an enormous archive of, 150-year-old archive, or more than that, of slides and all sorts of things. And he became fascinated by the story of the Spanish flu, which had killed millions of people. They say up to 80 million, more people than had been killed in the First World War. And it happened just after the end of the First World War. And he was fascinated by the fact that very few, this wasn't sort of part of the sort of folk history of children in schools and so on. And he wondered why so few people knew about it. And so he got to investigating it, and he decided he was going to try and track down what this virus was and what had made it so virulent. And he managed to find a couple of slides from a couple of soldiers who had died of the Spanish flu in the archives. But these were ancient, ancient archives, as you can imagine, I mean, from 1918. And he was trying to sort of tease out bits of the DNA of the virus. And he got quite a lot of it, and he read quite a lot of the sequence, but it was still incomplete. And then, when he published the story of that, he got a letter from a gentleman from Norway who had been, who was another pathologist, and he'd been fascinated by this project as well, or by this issue of what had made the 1918 flu virus so particularly virulent. And he offered to go and dig up some bodies from the permafrost, which would be much better preserved. And so he went up to Alaska and he'd been working with some people up there, and they allowed him to dig up some bodies, and he found a woman who died of the Spanish flu, and she was still quite well preserved. And they got more samples of this, and Jeffrey Taubenberger managed to get the full sequence of the virus. And they published that. And then I said, well, okay, so what? So you've now got a string of letters. What do you do with that? And he said that was exactly what they thought. You know, they were looking for it, and then they thought, oh, shit, now we found it. Now what? But they managed, through some wizardry of reverse genetics, to recreate the virus. And I think they've got several copies of this thing in the high containment labs in the States, which they're studying to see what it was that did make it so virulent. And they found all kinds of genetic mutations, and some of them, they say that some of the latest flu viruses have had some of the same mutations. And so, you know, this will be very important as we see next few flu seasons coming round.
We're out of time, so we'll have to finish there. Sue, thanks very much for speaking to us today. The book, A Matter of Life and Death, is published by Canongate. And, Sue, there's extended versions of all of the interviews and more that are available online. Can you tell us where we can find that?
Yes, it's in fact we're just about to launch the archive. It's on the Pathological Society website, www.pathsoc.org, and then if you look for Conversations with Pathologists, it comes up. But those are the unexpurgated versions, so it's got all the sort of heavier science in as well. But there's more interviews there as well.
Thanks again, Sue.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
You've been listening to Little Adams. You can find details of upcoming guests on our website at littleadams.com. The Little Adams podcast is available on iTunes. Thanks for listening. Thank you.